Hello, what's up everybody? Jack Farr here from Farr's Views Podcast. Finally, after 7 long weeks, Jack has come back to iTunes. That's my very half-assed rock impression. It's been a very, very long time since my last podcast, 7 weeks, as just stated. I've been kind of focusing on university and settling into kind of a new way of life, a new routine up in London. So I haven't really, I mean, don't get me wrong, I've definitely had the time to do this, just not the mental capacity or the motivation to do this week by week, even though I'm now at football university. So it would somewhat seem surprising that I didn't have the desire to do a football podcast based on it's actually what I'm learning. However, I digress. Just wanted to go over a couple of things. I doubt this will remain weekly again. It wouldn't surprise me if this only comes up every couple of weeks. But I feel as though it's something that that I did need to do, especially after I've kind of had my first quarter of the year now, of my first year of university. And I just kind of wanted to talk about it a little bit, maybe some things that I've learned. Couple of things that I think everybody may find interesting. Even though I've only been there about 6 or 7 weeks now, I feel as though I really am kind of in the weeds to a certain extent. There's especially from some of the reading I've been doing, a couple of books that I've bought and kind of getting my head into. I'm not much of a reader anyway, but kind of getting my head into these books and learning some really important stuff that I think lots of the time goes really unnoticed. So yeah, I'm just going to get into it straight away. So as I said, now I've been at university 6 or 7 weeks, weeks or so. I'm doing 2 modules for this first semester, which is the kind of introduction to football business and the introduction to accounting and finance. The accounting and finance side really has very little to do with football. It's mainly just getting the basics of the terminology, the theory, and the reasoning behind any sort of accounting and finance. It will easily be my weakest point throughout my degree. So obviously a little bit concerning, and I will need to really get my head down and learn from these lectures and seminars, because it's not something I'm truly blessed with. If you're looking at all of the accounting and finance stuff in layman's terms, I think that actually it's very, very easy to understand. But it's the terminology that you have to try and get your head around, and that's what I think mainly confuses people. But the thing is, when you are looking for a term, you can't just go out and over-explain everything in layman's terms. So unfortunately, you have to have words that represent long, complex ideas and equations and calculations, which, you know, to anybody who's been used to it makes perfect sense, but it's just getting your head around it. And like I say, it's very, very basic, and I'm getting a reasonable handle on it, but at the moment it's very little to do with football at the moment. The other course, the understanding football business to begin with, is very interesting, certainly looking at it from competitive balance in sport, the women's game, and the history of that, the development of English football, all this kind of stuff. I'm finding it very interesting, and I think I said to a friend recently, if there was no degree at the end of it and it was just a class for fun that I would go to, I'd go to this every week. I really, really do enjoy it, and I'm really kind of enjoying getting to grips with some of the sides of the game that I think people ignore. My biggest gripe most of the time with football is that there are living rooms all around the UK and all around the world where somebody says something and they don't even know if it's true. It just sounds about right. And then they base all of their opinions and their assessments off something that isn't even factually correct. So most of the time, you'll hear something really, really stupid and you'll think, oh no, it sounds right. That guy sounds like he knows what he's talking about. So all my opinions and assessments and our entire conversation going forward is going to be based on that. And I'd have thought that obviously the pundits at the highest levels, you know, you have BT Sport, Sky Sports, ITV, BBC, all these kind of companies and channels, that they would have this kind of level of understanding of what's going on to help influence everybody else around them. But that really isn't the case, unfortunately. So I just wanted to say, you know, talk about a couple of things that I found out just from a little bit of extensive reading and a couple of things that I've been taught, which I think people might find really interesting and may in future make you realize maybe what it is that you're talking about, the reason behind success, and that a lot of the miscellaneous nature of football that people dwell on actually really doesn't actually matter too much. So the one really interesting one that I've looked at recently is it's called Money in Football. It's the Soccernomics Guide by I think Stefan Szymanski and Simon Cooper, Kuper, and the one chapter that I was looking at is for the Premier League since its inception in 92. The winners of the competition for the past 25 or however many years have all been, it's always been the team with a top three wage bill. So what that means is the times that United have won it, City have won it, Chelsea have won it, Arsenal have won it, etc. It's always been that the winner has always had a top three wage bill throughout the year. So they're paying their players and their staff and whatnot the most. And obviously most of that will be down to players. I think there's a couple of exceptions. I think Blackburn, who won it in 94. Blackburn were a team that I think were fourth in their wage budget, I think. So you could extend it and say that every single time it's been a top four wage budgets, with the one anomaly, of course, being Leicester City. So personally, I just found that very interesting. I feel like what a lot of people do at the beginning of each season is they look at a couple of people and say, you know, they could make a title challenge, but we have 25 years, and probably, you know, if the research was done a few years before that as well, I would assume we have a lot more to go from in terms of data, where it's the top three teams en masse, you know, a very high percentage of the time, 90 plus percent of the time, it's a team with a top three wage budget that wins the league. Now, I'm sure many of you are listening to this and thinking, Jesus Christ, well, isn't that fucking obvious? Like, the best players earn the most money, the best players are on the best teams, and then that all makes perfect sense. Of course that would be the case. But what I think is really interesting is that the moment you, before a season starts, no matter who you're picking to win the league, so Spurs right now would be a really, really good example for that. I'm sure most of you would have picked one of the Manchester teams, probably Manchester City, to win the league. But you look at it going forward and you think maybe a couple of people have gone, you know, Spurs, they've got the most points than any of the teams in the Premier League since 2017 started. So the arse end of last year and the beginning of this year, they've got more points than anybody else, you know, they're really pushing somewhere. Kane's the best, in my opinion, at this point in time, Kane is the best striker in the world. Christian Eriksen, Dele Alli, one of the best defences in Europe's top five leagues. Great goalkeeper, solid midfield. You know, Spurs really could make a push. What I think is interesting is if you ignore the on-field tactics and you purely look at it from a business point of view, what happens is the top three teams in terms of wage budget, I don't know this for a fact, but I would assume that this is the case, is going to be Manchester City, Manchester United, and Chelsea. So before the season even starts, you have three teams that are potentially going to win the league based on that previous 25 years of data. Now, Spurs team, even with its quality over however many couple of years it's been, maybe 3 or 4 years or so, Kane winning the Golden Boot for consecutive years and them doing this really well within the certain wage budget that they've got. Based on that information, because they're not in the top three, they have a very, very, very slim chance of winning it, historically speaking. Now, I'm sure you can come at me with football terms and telling me that, oh yeah, but they play this formation and their players are certainly reaching their peak at this point. They've made some good signings. Historically speaking, from a business point of view, statistically speaking, the probability is that they will not be winning the league and it will be either of the two Manchester teams or the Chelsea team. Now, like I said, I'm sure that's not shocking to you. I'm sure you wouldn't have been able to just quote that for a fact beforehand, and it's just something that kind of makes perfect sense. But I think I just found it very, very interesting, and it just shows the almost the lack of competitiveness in the Premier League, and that really, apart from the one anomaly that is Leicester City, that really the person who spends the most wins the most. And I think that really is kind of sad, as much as, you know, as great as Spurs have been over the past couple of years, it really is a shame that when you look at the, you know, cold hard facts, that really they're probably not going to win the league this year, they're not going to win the league next year, and it's only when they start paying their players more that you can really give them a chance based on these statistics. So I just thought that was kind of interesting. The only other little nugget of information that I've kind of learned that I find quite interesting, that I think that some of you may look at and think, oh wow, that's kind of cool, I didn't know that, is if I were to ask you, what would you guess that the percentage of a team's revenue over an entire year, so all the money they've made from ticket receipts, sponsorship, television rights, all this kind of stuff, all sorts of deals, how much money do you think, as a percentage of the entire year's revenue, a football club would need to spend on its wages, on its player wages, as a percentage over the course of a year? What would you say that would be? So after speaking to other people about this, people have said, you know, like 12%, 20%, because they know that player wages are high, and they think, oh yeah, you know, not crazy amounts, but obviously I'm thinking reasonable, you know, 15, 20%. Well, on average in the Premier League, it's about 60-65% roughly. And obviously, you know, what this kind of does is, first of all, it shocks you into thinking, Jesus Christ, 65% of all that a team makes from all that money that they get, and this is just in the Premier League, by the way, all the money that they get, that they get, and 60-65% of it will go to their player wages. That's crazy. That's madness. And you look at it and you really do kind of think, well, you know, Jesus, that doesn't sound great at all. But yeah, again, it's why transfer fees, everyone really does kind of get hung up on transfer fees. The real fucker for a football club is a player's wages. You can be as shocked as you like spending a bunch of money on a player going forward, but what that player will then do for you over the years that you have them will then reap back that reward. If you look at the effect that Neymar, this is just as an example because it's the most extreme one there is, if you look at the effect that Neymar is going to have on PSG and Mbappe next year, of course, as well, when that transfer finally goes through, if you look at the effect of those two players that are going to have on PSG as a club, as a brand, as an entity going forward, it's close to limitless. Messi and Ronaldo will get to retirement age and will stop winning Ballon d'Ors and beating records and scoring 100 plus goals in the Champions League, which is ridiculous and totally unheard of. Excuse me. And they will eventually have what you would assume is, if not a shoe-in for the Ballon d'Or winner every year, definitely a top three player for years and years to come, followed with Mbappe, who, if he fulfills his potential, as many people are predicting he will, another potential Ballon d'Or winner. And that sexy attacking front three that everyone craves and tries to have, you know, the what was the BBC, Bale, Benzema, and Cristiano, MSN, you know, all these kind of trendy little things that they've got. Obviously Neymar, Mbappe, and Cavani. Obviously Cavani, I'm sure, will be replaced in the next couple of years. You look at that going forward and you actually go, well, hang on a minute, it's not the transfer fee that's going to be the issue. It's how much these players are demanding in wages and how much that is going to cripple our club. So I just think that's interesting. I think the media and I think the folk at home get really hung up on transfer fees and how much somebody is a rip-off or how much somebody's not a rip-off. This is where you really have to admire teams like Arsenal and Spurs, who do get a lot of shit. Trust me, they do. But like I said, the average that a team's going to spend is about 60-65% on player wages of their total revenue. Arsenal and Spurs are both about around 50-54%. I think Spurs may even be in the 40s. So looking at that, and of course they make more money from finishing in the top spaces, but they're still not then going, oh, we have an extra 20% of our wage bill to spend to meet the average for player wages. They keep it that way so that they can buy new stadiums, so that they can give their shareholders more money, so that they can do this, 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 and this. It may also surprise you that Manchester United and Manchester City's wage percentage of their entire year's revenue is lower than the average as well. But yet again, we're looking at the potential revenue that they're going to get throughout a year is obviously significantly higher than some of the quote-unquote smaller teams in the Premier League. They are having to spend the higher wages to compete to get more money, whereas these clubs that are solidified at the top have the revenue, so then don't have to spend as much as their revenue on player wages, even though they can if they want to. So I just think that's really, really interesting. I think that's something that a lot of people will get hung up on, and I think the transfer fee, you know. Everyone has in their head what makes somebody worth a certain amount of money. And actually, the thing that screws you in the long term really is the wages. So Yaya Toure, for example, is burning a hole in Manchester City's team because he's on, I think, what was it, 250, 300K or something mad a week. And he barely plays. He's a rotation player. Now that, if you keep in mind, in a month, that's a million, give or take, £1 million a month. That is going to Yaya Toure, or most of it to the tax man, in terms of player wages. And that's the thing that's killing them, not the transfer fee they managed to sign him for from Barcelona. So yeah, that I just kind of thought was really interesting. Those are the just, I know I went on those for quite a long period of time, but it is important, I think, to not get hung up on what you think is affecting a club and actually looking at it in a little bit more detail and going, that means nothing. Here's what's actually affecting the club going forward. So those two things I found really interesting. The cold hard fact that if you don't have a top three wage bill in the Premier League, you're not going to win the league. And the percentage, like I say, the average is about 65% of your total revenue over a year goes towards player wages. And that's the thing that really cripples you as a club going forward, and to not get too hung up on transfer fees. So those were two really interesting things I've kind of learned recently that I wanted to kind of share with you. Next, I just wanted to talk about some of the English teams and how they're progressing in world football. I'd say what you're really looking at is I don't know if the English teams have gotten significantly better. I would say I think that Chelsea have dropped off a little bit. I think Spurs have remained roughly the same. I think Manchester United have improved. I think Manchester City have improved. I think Arsenal have dropped off a little bit as well. And Liverpool have remained much the same. However, I think that the Italian teams have massively gone up in my estimation. I'm watching a lot of Serie A this year. If you follow me on Instagram or on Twitter, at TheJackFar, you will see how much love I have for the Italian league, and I'm sure there'll be 50 more tweets this and Instagram posts this year about how you should watch the Italian league. Derby Milano, I made a lot of fuss about on social media, and what a fucking game it was. 3-2 to Inter, my favourite player at the moment, Mauro Icardi, scoring a hat-trick and then doing the Messi shirt celebration, which I thought was amazing. Yeah, watch the Italian league. It's really cool. There's about five or six teams who could realistically win the league this year. Usually it's just Juve and maybe one or two teams fighting them. AC Milan are gelling week after week. I'm still not totally convinced by them, but they are gelling week after week, and the quality in that squad is very, very top notch. Inter Milan made some really good signings in the summer. They kept hold of some really good players, Perisic being the prime example. Juve are always smart with their buys and will always be competitive. Napoli and their top three, you know, it still baffles me to this day that a player of Gabbiadini's quality can just be sold from Napoli. But then when you look at their attacking four that they've got in Mertens, Callejon, Insigne, Marek Hamsik. Milik, I think, is still to come back. Or, you know, they have such attacking prowess, really solid in midfield, very decent at the back. Koulibaly being a prime example at the back for them. Reina, veteran goalkeeper, who's still pretty good to this day. Roma, even though they've made some key losses, are still so strong. I'm so in love with their midfield. Still think De Rossi should start over Gonalon. But Kevin Strootman's one of my absolute favourite players. Roma are probably my favourite team in the world at the moment. And Raja Nangalan is crazy good. Florenzi, for me, is the best right-back in the world at the moment. You know, of course they miss Salah. Of course they miss Rudiger. But I still just think that Roma is still going to be really competitive. Who am I missing? Lazio, you know, still competitive. Ciro Immobile is incredible. I was tweeting at, I think his name's David Amoyal. I think he's some sort of football reporter on Twitter. He's definitely worth a follow. And he was asking, you know, Andrea Belotti or Ciro Immobile. And I was kind of like, oh, it's Belotti all day. Because, you know, his goals are fantastic. He plays in a really inferior team and still shows his quality. Man, Immobile is getting well up there. Immobile is getting way up there in my estimation. And for me, is probably better than Belotti at the moment. I still like Belotti more as a player, but I think Immobile is probably still better. So, yeah, the Italian league's getting way up there. I think the Spanish league's dropped off. I think the Real Madrid missed the trick in missing out on signing a true superstar in the summer. I think that they should have signed Mbappe, or they should have signed Hazard, or they should have signed, you know, Sanchez, or they should have signed somebody big as a big name player. I know they've got some serious youth players coming through, and that they've shored up their defense for the future by bringing young players through. And offloading some players like James, for example, and allowing Isco to play more, who's superb. Asensio, getting rid of Danilo. You know, they've still showing a lot of faith in Carvajal. They've got the youth player, the Moroccan guy, who's come through and looked really strong. Theo Hernandez will be an incredible player. Varane is now starting very, very consistently. He's quality. But I still think Real missed a trick in not signing a superstar in the summer. Obviously, Barcelona got very unlucky with Ousmane Dembele's injury. But Barca is still looking strong. But I think Spain have dropped off. I do. And I don't think they'll be where they should be in the Champions League this year. I still expect probably both teams in the semi-finals. But it's not as much of a sure thing as I think it was last year. Bayern... Yeah, for me it's complacency. It's going to be the problem that every Bayern coach and supporter has with Bayern Munich every single year. For me, it's still arguably the easiest. It used to be when PSG had Zlatan and Cavani, that used to, for me, be the easiest team to play for PSG. But obviously with the rising in quality in Liga at the moment, because France is on the up as well. Nobody's talking about it, but France is on the up. They've got, you know, Marseille looking a lot better, Lyon looking a lot better. A couple of their youth players have not been signed by the more elite teams as potential players, and they're reaching their potentials at their club. So looking at players like Nabil Fekir is a really, really good example of somebody who is getting better and better and better, and nobody's actually signed him yet. So I think that's really interesting, and they're doing it in the French league. And the other teams are kind of catching up a little bit. Monaco have obviously dropped off due to the fact they got absolutely killed in the transfer market, even though, in my opinion, they made some very, very reasonable replacements within their means. So, yeah, French league's really on the up. Italian league's on the up. For me, Germany and Spain is on the down. And England's on the way up as well. I think we're probably going to have 5 English teams in the knockout phases. It would surprise me a great deal if we didn't have an English team in the semi-finals. And by an extension, Jose Mourinho knows exactly what he's doing in Europe. Pep and that City team know exactly what they're... Well, Pep knows what he's doing in Europe. The Chelsea team are going to be very hard to beat away from home. Spurs with Kane, I think, are capable of anything, and that really strong defensive unit. And Liverpool on their day can outscore anybody, and it will just be a complete shootout of who can score more goals. So I've got a lot of faith in the English teams, and I think there's been a really interesting shift in power where it's not just, right, who's it going to be? Real, Barca, Atleti, Bayern, and maybe Juve in the finals. It's now, well, hang on a minute, PSG are going to really make a claim to make it to the final. You know, any of the English teams could certainly look to be in the semis for sure. The Italian teams, I don't think, are at that elite level to compete in the Champions League just yet, but the league itself is on the way up. And I just think that Real aren't looking as good as they did last year, but could obviously easily turn it around because they've just got one of the best teams. Barca, obviously strong from wherever, and Messi can do whatever he wants. And Bayern, if they get their heads together, could still be dangerous. I just think there's been an interesting shift in power. And like I say, France and Italy have really, really kind of upped their game. And I think England's remained relatively much the same. But I think that we're looking at a drop-off from Spain and Germany. So yeah, that was just kind of a quick analysis of where I see world football and kind of the power struggle at the moment. And where we can see the Champions League going in the future. Next thing I wanted to talk about was just Jose Mourinho. Just very quickly touch on the fact that any Manchester United fan or any fan of, or just general fan, as I am or I try to be, Jose Mourinho will not be at United in maybe a year and a half, 2 years' time. I just don't see it. He very much is, he's the kind of example I was given, this has just come to me now. So you meet a nice girl or a nice guy, whatever, and you have a nice honeymoon period where, man, the sex is really good and you've got a lot of chemistry, you're making each other laugh, everything's going great. And then after a few kind of months, 6 months, maybe to a year, you start to get into the serious stuff about, maybe we should move in together, maybe you move your stuff to my place, I move stuff to your place, maybe we look at maybe getting married, maybe I'll propose to you going forward, and you start to get to the serious stuff, and maybe some of the glitzy stuff that happens in the honeymoon period isn't quite there anymore. And I think that whenever things come to serious commitment with Mourinho, I think he gets a little scared and he wants a fresh start and to create a storyline somewhere else. So unless a major change in his personality or coaching style comes anytime soon, I think that Mourinho won't be at United any longer than the 3 years or two and a bit years, like he is at all clubs. It would not surprise me in the slightest if he and United won the league this year or next year, or won the EFL Cup or the FA Cup again, or challenged maybe a semi-final run in the Champions League, and you know, he still said that, you know, we're still there or thereabouts. But the PSG offer is going to come up at some point. PSG want the future best players in the world. They want the quote-unquote best manager in the world. And I think that when Mourinho does hang up his tie, I guess you'd call it, that he will probably be regarded as the greatest football manager of all time, purely based on the trophies he wins and the results. And the argument will always be where he's done it, the amount of places he's done it, the teams he's done it for. A Portuguese team winning the Champions League was crazy. Inter Milan winning, I mean, it was a great team, but them winning, you know, it was all huge for Mourinho. And the only person obviously to catch him will be Pep. But I would still maintain that in each of the leagues that Pep's been in, Pep's had the best squad in each of those leagues in the times that he's been there. Man City had the best squad in England since he's been there. Bayern had the best squad in Germany since he's been there. And Barca, at his time there, had the best squad, arguably, of all time. So I'm still, as you guys know if you've listened to me before, I still think Pep's overrated. I'm not saying he's bad. I just still maintain that he is overrated. That's where I see Mourinho going. But yes, anyway, back to my original point. Mourinho won't be at United that much longer. PSG will come calling, and don't break your heart over it. It's going to happen. They'll offer him a lot of money, and he'll be in a place where he can probably win domestic league titles year after year, and he'll be able to have a good shot at the Champions League each year. It's what he does. He's a great character, and I'm sure he'd come back to the Premier League and manage some other team at some point, or maybe international management. I don't know. But yeah, and then the last thing I wanted to touch on, I was going to try and keep this under half an hour, but that's not going to happen now, is just look at just a quick weekend preview. Just wanted to look at some of the fixtures coming up and give you my quick 2 cents on each, and very, very quickly, kind of a quick fire thing, and then I'll close out. So the 12:30 game tomorrow is Manchester United against Tottenham. Harry Kane has been ruled out which is awful. Certainly spoils the spectacle for me a little bit. I think Spurs would have gone into the game honestly trying to win it. I mean, don't get me wrong, they'd have protected themselves at the back because, you know, United, of course, can be very, very dangerous, especially at home. But I think Spurs would have thought, we can go and win this game very, very easily. I don't know if Eric Bailly is going to be playing. Don't know if Jones is going to be playing. Rashford, I think, was also potentially a doubt. Lukaku has been struggling for a bit of fitness recently. But Kane missing out is a real shame. It does spoil the spectacle. Like I say, for me, he is the best number nine in the world at the moment. I say number nine because I refuse to include Messi or Ronaldo or Dybala as number nines. Then his only real competition would be Aubameyang, who's not at it. Lewandowski, who's not at it. Suarez, who's not at it. Icardi, who's playing phenomenal football, but I would still say that Kane is probably better than Icardi at this point. So yeah, that's where I look at it from that point. But yeah, I see a close game. I think if Kane was playing, United would have taken a draw, but now United will be looking to win the game. So unless Spurs are going to try and do a major kind of counter-attack side of things, maybe play Moussa Sissoko. Like I say, I don't rate him at all. He's just quick. But like I say, counter-attack, quick. It's a good combo. So maybe that'll be that. The only one thing I will say is people should not sleep on Fernando Llorente. I rate him as a disruptive force. He has played at a very reasonable level for a very long time. I believe he was at Athletic Bilbao, which is the Spanish team that I root for, and he was very, very strong there. You don't play at Juve at that kind of high level without being good at football. Keep in mind, Fernando Llorente was a starting player at Juventus at one point. This is no kind of slouch, okay? Just because he's played for Swansea, because he liked how many zeros were on the end of his paycheck, does not mean that this is somebody who's just means that, oh, they've lost Kane, they're screwed now. Llorente will disrupt the back line. If Lindelof plays as well, you can bet your ass that Fernando Llorente is going to stick on Lindelof and try and scare him. He'll knock the ball down for creative players like Ali and Eriksen, who could definitely trouble United. So I wouldn't, like I say, I wouldn't sleep on Fernando Llorente. And obviously United going forward, it's going to be much the same thing. And they're just going to be looking to get a couple of goals and then retain possession for as long as they can. Arsenal-Swansea, I would assume that Arsenal will win the game. Paul Clement, I rate so highly as a coach, but Arsenal playing Lacazette, Sanchez and Ozil for the first time in a long time, they need to keep doing that. That's three incredible players. I don't care what formation they use them in, just make sure those three players are on the pitch and you're going to make stuff happen. Palace against West Ham, that's a really weird one. Wilfried Zaha is a huge influence. West Ham have just made kind of a season-defining win against Spurs in the Carabao Cup. Manuel Lanzini is back. You definitely can't underestimate his influence as well. He is unreal, and by just an absolute mile, maybe Mikel Antonio, but Antonio and Lanzini playing in the same team, that's seriously dangerous for Palace. But yet again, you can't underestimate what Wilfried Zaha can do. Liverpool-Huddersfield, yet again, I think Coutinho's back. He may be a doubt, actually, but I just think Liverpool are going to have too much for Huddersfield. I've got a feeling that, you know, especially at Anfield, there's just going to be a lot of goals, and I don't know what Huddersfield can do apart from try and stop them and maybe get them on the break. Watford-Stoke, I think Watford are going to win that game. They're playing really, really well at the moment. Marco Silva is a really, really good coach and wasn't supported as well as he could have been at Hull. I think they missed a trick there. But yeah, they're playing really well. And Stoke, yet again, there's so much quality in that squad, which you'd be really surprised to hear and to know based on the history of some of the players at the club and what they've been brought through, the teams they've played for. But they're either going to come out and kill you or they're going to come out and just roll over and show you their belly. So don't know about that. West Brom City is going to be the perfect example of a game where even though City are the away team, I still get the feeling that it's going to be West Brom a bank of four and a bank of five, and then City trying to break them down and then trying to get them on the break. Bournemouth-Chelsea, yeah, again, Chelsea, I'm sure, will just walk that. They'll go one goal up, I would say, and then probably try and retain possession, play it long out wide to the fullbacks, then get going forward. I see a win for Chelsea there. Brighton and Hove Albion against Southampton, that's going to be a tough game to call. I would still maintain that Saints are probably going to win. they certainly look a lot better now, and I think Shane Long not starting is probably going to be the best remedy there. Leicester against Everton, I think it's actually a really interesting game, just because you've got a lot of speed up front for Leicester, and Everton are obviously very big at the back, so that's a really interesting matchup. But I think Everton, I went to the Everton-Chelsea game midweek, and Everton looked pretty good. They did. They scared Chelsea a bit, and Chelsea obviously came away with the win, but there were a few little scares for Chelsea. It wasn't a fully strengthened Chelsea team. No Fabregas, no Bakayoko, no Kante, no Morata, no Hazard, etc. So a lot of key players missing. But Everton weren't playing their total full strength team either. And I just wonder, you know, maybe Everton are looking a little bit better. But yeah, that game I really couldn't call. I'd say maybe a score draw. And then the Monday game, Burnley against Newcastle. I don't really know what to say about that game. I rate Sean Dyche as a manager, and I think he'll have prepared well for Newcastle, so I think Burnley will probably get the win there. So yeah, I've overrun. Unfortunately, I was trying to keep it over under half an hour, but I have overrun. A real kind of clusterfuck, so to speak, of topics today, and I know I went off on a couple of tangents, as I'm very likely to do. But yes, thank you very, very much for listening. Please give me a subscribe, give me a review, tell your friends, give me a retweet, etc., etc. I'm sure I won't have another podcast after this one, but this was episode 14, closing out and signing off. Thanks for listening.